You don't want to ramble, right? I can do that for hours.
Let me just ask.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't think I do, actually.
Mark, do me a favor.
Thanks a lot, though.
Put them someplace
else. Yeah, I don't want to refer them.
You know, you're bringing them back. Painful.
So this is really old stuff.
So, if you look at the edge of stuff, it's already turned yellow.
Well, that's an interesting object lesson.
Yeah. 15 years ago.
16 years ago. And certainly your picture doesn't look like you look
like. Right. No, I think. The only thing good about it is I look better now than I did in that picture. Of course, I got to try to get in position.
Oh, that's so fun.
All right. All right, again. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight, and welcome to our panel event, Rethinking the New Left. This event is hosted by the Platypus Affiliated Society. Platypus was a project founded in 2006 dedicated to investigating the history of the left. We have chapters throughout the city of Chicago, including here at the University of Chicago, School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and at Loyola. We host weekly reading groups at the University of Chicago and SAIC that meet each Saturday. We also have a print side, the Platypus Review, a selection of which you can find at the table outside of the auditorium. Finally, we organize events, including this forum. We have two upcoming events, which are follow-up events to this panel. Tomorrow at 6 o'clock at Loyola University, at 6:30 p.m., excuse me, at Loyola at Dumbach Hall, we have an interview with Tim Woolforth, one of our panelists here tonight. And we also have a teach-in at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Black Man Speaks of Marx, the Sartre-Fanon Dialogue of the 40s and 50s, on November 17th at 5 p.m. in Stevenson Hall, that will be led by Spencer Leonard. Information for all of our events, reading groups, syllabi, and the Platypus Review can be found on our website. The website is www.platypus1917.org. Now I'll turn it over to our moderator for the night, Spencer Leonard.
My name is Spencer Leonard. I'm a professor in the college here at the University of Chicago. And I want to thank everyone for coming. I also want to thank Brian, who has taken the lead in Brian Worley, who has taken the lead in organizing this event, together with the support of our chapter head, Tana Forrester, and Watson Ladd, all of whom have done a great deal of work to make this possible. I won't carry on at any length. I only wish to introduce the panelists, give you a sense of the format of how we will proceed, and to assure you that I will keep things within bounds in terms of our time. We're going to conduct the panel for about 2 hours and a quarter, hopefully, which will mean that we will be over around 8:30 or 8:35. Now, our panelists from your right to left are the following: Eucken Neumann, or should I say Neumann or Newman?
It's spelled Neumann, and I say Newman.
You say Newman. Eucken Neumann at the far end, in the 1960s, was a member of the group the Motherfuckers in New York, which were a kind of performance art and political organization. He has written a book, which he's brought some copies of, Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker, a memoir from that movement, which I would encourage you all to talk to him about if you're interested in buying. He is now a public interest lawyer and a mural painter and sculptor. Beside him, to your left, is Mark Rudd. Mark is a former member of SDS, was the, I believe, the head of the SDS chapter at Columbia in 1968 when the famous takeover took place there, and later was one of the most prominent members of SDS to join what later was known as the Weather Underground, which he dropped out of before the end, pretty early in the 70s, and I believe since then has been an educator. Now, Mark has also written a book reflecting upon his experiences in the 1960s, one about which I conducted an interview with him on the radio, and which a transcript of which is published in an issue of the Platypus Review Outside, which I recommend that you all read. The name of his book is Underground, and I believe it came out in 2008 or 2009. To his right, your left, we have Tim Wolferth. Tim was a founder of and national secretary of the Young Socialist Alliance in 1959. Again, an author who has reflected upon his political experience in the late 50s, 60s, and beyond, most prominently in his book, The Prophet's Children. He's also written an article in the New Left Review, which is called America in the 1960s, which he published in 1989, and which I would recommend that you have a look at. And finally, we have Alan Spector. And Alan was a full-time organizer for SDS for 5 years, and a traveling organizer for SDS for three, primarily in New England. And he is now a professor of sociology at Purdue University Calumet. I don't want to take up any more of your time other than to say that we are going to proceed in the following manner. Each speaker will have roughly 10 minutes to address the question that we have circulated to them, which I will read for your benefit in just a moment. And after that, we're going to allow them to respond to one another for a period of 3 to 5 minutes each. After that, I may exercise the prerogative of asking a few questions myself, at which point I will open it up to the floor, but I will certainly make sure that there'll be plenty of time for questions from the floor. We, of course, have a mic here, which we will use when the time comes. The question that was circulated to our panelists, and to which we hope they will address their opening comments now, runs as follows. How do you assess the world historical or historical situation that you inherited as a young person, and how did that inform your political task? If this meant breaking with the old left, what old left? And what about that old left appeared anachronistic to you when you were first becoming political? Why did there need to be a new left? Had something fundamental changed after the Second World War, and therefore a new kind of left needed to be built? Or was there a particular event, such as the Khrushchev revelations, the revolution in Hungary, the Cuban Revolution, McCarthyism, the civil rights movement, or the emerging war in Vietnam, that challenged you to refashion the left? What was your relationship to the existing movements of the era? The civil rights, the anti-war, the free speech, the student movement, the labor movement, etc. And how did these inform your political imagination? What kind of world were you fighting for? How did you seek to give your political aspirations organizational form? What informed the way you organized and built political groups during this era? And how did your relationship to different organizations change over the course of the 1960s? And the final part of this rather extended and complex question is the counterculture believed itself to constitute an alternative form of politics. But history in some ways seems to have called this into question, at least insofar as the counterculture was thought to be unassimilable to the mainstream. As Daniel Cohn-Bendit remarked of the 1960s in 2008, we succeeded culturally, we succeeded socially, but we lost politically, to which I always say, thank God. Do you agree with Cohn-Bendit's assessment of historical outcomes? And if so, do you agree with him that this was for the best? So without further ado, I believe we will start with Osha. And
do you want me to go up there?
Are all the mics on? Yeah. You can feel free to sit if you want.
Okay.
And then we'll just come down the table.
Okay, sounds good.
I never got those questions. These questions.
As you will quickly see, I'm going to address these questions, if at all, only obliquely. My old motherfucker personality doesn't completely disappear. And before I begin talking about any substance, I want to talk about this event and the structure of the event, because I think the form of this event gives the meaning as much as the content. I wrote Spencer when I found out what the lineup of the event was. Goodness gracious, this feels like a blast from the past. No women, I'm guessing no people of color. Whatever do you expect to come out of this? And he wrote me back, "We're more interested in reflection upon political experience than on identity, so we did not make those concerns determinative. Of course, some blacks and women were invited, and some are participating in the sister panel to this one on the radical turn of the 70s, but none could make it for this panel. Personally, I don't think it matters much." I have to disagree. I think it does matter. It makes it easy to universalize our experience, and make a white experience into a universal experience, a very old problem. And I know that this gets also to the issue of identity politics and people's feelings about it. My feeling is you don't get to the universal by bypassing the particular and the individual. And you don't get to a unified movement by doing an end run around identity. So I do think it matters. Second of all, just the form of these panels, you know, in universities, guys up here talking and, you know, intellectual, and we begin to sort of fan our peacock tails of intellect and, you know, go on and on like that. And to me, in at least in the old days, it was absolute anathema to me because it absolutely lacked the kind of urgency that I felt was absolutely crucial and the connection to action. And at that time, if I was up on the panel, my tendency would be to get up at this point out of my seat and shout, "Up against the wall, motherfucker!" But I'm not going to do that.
No, that comes later.
Okay, comes later.
Right, right.
And then maybe throw something.
How about turning over the
table? No, yeah, I wouldn't do that, but I'm not going to do that.
All right,
I remember those exact words.
I'm sure you do. And it's not because I don't still have a frustration with theory that escapes and has nothing to do with practice. It's a lot safer to talk than to go out into the streets and actually do something. And I think the divorce between thought and action, idea and reality, theory and practice is very real. It's a class-based thing, and it has a negative effect all around on our movement.
I think we should seize this building right
no,
now.
Wait, no, Mark, no, okay. Not going to do that. Okay. On the other hand, I do also think that our preference for the propaganda of the action and for the deed over all theorizing also was problematic. So that's, I mean, just to get that out of the way. So now what I think is the real question that is important right now, and I'd sum it up this way, that back in the 60s, we had a movement, but not a crisis of capitalism, and now we have a crisis of capitalism and essentially no movement, at least none adequate to the situation. Now, I guess that actually is behind the thinking of this panel. I mean, it's presented fairly neutrally, but again, I have a feeling I may prove wrong that there'll be a tendency to attribute the fact that we don't have a movement now essentially to us. Back then, it was our fault with our sort of expressive, narcissistic, thrill-seeking, confrontational politics that never targeted capitalism, never did the hard work of organizing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And my tendency to believe this also comes, Spencer, from your email, where in I know it's a little, I hope you don't mind me quoting your email, but it's everything is public these days. I mean, where you said that the panel was, you wanted to reflect on the 60s as a history responsible not only for liberation, the typical triumphalist narrative, but also responsible for our discontent in as much as it superintended over what at least in some unmistakable, if obscure sense, must be accounted the liquidation of the left worldwide. And at this point, I'm tempted to rescind my decision not to out and stand out and shout again, that's bullshit and you know it. Now, Mark said he was going to join me with this, but he is not going to back me up because he is in a period of good feeling and all of this aggression of the 60s he has completely renounced, and I'm sure he's a better person for it. But I'm not going to give in to that temptation either. But let me say, first of all, the first assumption that we liquidated a pre-existing left, at least in my experience in the left in the 50s, was totally moribund, and there was nothing that to be liquidated. It had essentially been self-liquidated or liquidated by McCarthyism. And the second assumption, that the left has been liquidated worldwide. Worldwide, that certainly is not the case. If you just look, French workers, Greek workers, look what's happening in Latin America. I mean, in some ways, it's stronger than ever in Bolivia and Venezuela and Chile. It's actually taken power to some degree. And in the United States, I would not say the left has been liquidated. I say essentially that it has been dispersed, that it has opened up and spread, sort of like a seed pod that burst open and has spread many different varying arrays of movements, but not the movement. Not that it was ever that unified back then either. That said, it's indisputable that we don't have the kind of movement we need commensurate with a crisis, one that could actually turn this crisis into an opportunity. And that said also, I'm not opposed to analyzing the shortcomings of the movements of the 60s, and I'm certainly not into romanticizing them. My book is in many ways an antidote to that. So I can make my own list of some of the failures and mistakes, in quote, of the 60s. Failure to rein in the loosened id when it led us to ignore the warning signs that we were in danger of self-destruction. Failure to marry reason with imagination and leaven the imagination with reason. Assuming a vocabulary and a practice derived from other people's struggles and assuming it would work in our situation, over a reliance on action, over organizing, failure to ask whether it's even possible to imagine a revolutionary change in the United States that bypassed the electoral process entirely, failure to come to grips with the question of the political effectiveness of violence and nonviolence, idolatry of those who took up the gun, contempt for those who hesitated and compromised. They used to say back then, you know, it was a slogan from Eldridge Cleaver, you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. I actually don't believe that. I think people are usually a little bit of both.
Now who's getting mellow?
I have. Yeah. Sweeping away the distinction between the person and the political without questioning the degree to which we thereby limited our appeal to those who still had to live actually within roles and valued their privacy. And finally, failure to find a way to expand and deepen our base while retaining our militancy. But I have to say that I believe our mistakes were intimately linked to our strengths. And the strengths and weaknesses have a common ground, which is that we were a movement of outsiders to the system, not the working class, not those embedded in the system whose lives were shaped by the needs to be part of it. There were no strikes, certainly no possibility of a general strike. The workforce continued largely to be satisfied, functioning, and rewarded. And because it came from the outside, and this is where the strength was, it could be total. A great refusal, a rejection of all aspects of regimentation and regulation of the self required to be a good worker, citizen, and member of the family. That was a strength. But participation was restricted to those who were in a position to make that complete break. Then again, the movement was a revolt against the reason of the system, which we saw as linked quite rightly to its irrationality. The revolt aimed to break open the barriers to the imagination. Be realistic, demand the impossible, was a slogan of the French workers that we adopted. And every movement must claim the imagination for itself. There's no question about it. But the problem there was that the revolt against reason actually took the shape of this preference for action over theory, the demand for sort of immediate gratification, the thrill of combat, direct confrontation, and so on, all of which I certainly was largely a part of. And all of these problems I sum up with in this way, that we were unable at the same time to shout both freedom now and freedom not quite yet. And I actually think that's something that none of the movements since then, and is always going to be a problem for the movement. The strengths, though, that go with it, all of the weakness I've talked about, which are difficult to convey now. I think the weakness, we all know about weakness. We don't know that much about strength. The strength was that we felt we were incandescent, that it was thrilling to be alive, to feel ourselves part of that movement of liberation, to dedicate our lives to that movement, to be caught up in the urgency of transformation of ourselves and the lives on the planet, to take risks, to transgress, to feel a new love and a new rage. And I don't romanticize. My memoir is largely devoted to exposing the problems of that kind of desublimation. But nevertheless, there was a great deal in it that was profound and true and moving, and still is. And I don't believe that our failure was that if we had done it right, and no movement ever does, somehow it would be different. I think there were historical limitations. I think the system was too strong. It was still able to deliver the goods. And frankly, conditions were not ripe for revolution. And that's something that's really easy to say afterwards. And I hope every generation will make the try for revolution. And then maybe afterwards you'll find out whether the conditions were ripe. But there's no way of knowing without trying. So what now? There's an unprecedented dimension to the crisis now, which we didn't have then, which was the crisis of nature, that human beings are now becoming a problem for the planet, and we may be making it inhospitable. And we live with that looming dread that the species is endangered. And actually, I just ran across a quote from Frederick Jameson, a Marxist, who said, "These days, for many people, it's easier to imagine the death of the human species than the end of capitalism. And that's a profound problem, if that is true. Because I want to end with a quote from Evo Morales, the Bolivian president. And he says, "For Bolivians and for indigenous peoples, the idea is to live well. And this term, living well, is important as opposed to living better. Living well. Capitalism to live better pillages resources in an unbridled manner, exploits the children of Mother Earth, which are the human beings, destroys nature, squandering it. It causes so much damage to humanity." And he goes on, "We have two paths, either Pachamama, Mother Earth, or death. We have two paths, either capitalism dies or Mother Earth dies. Either capitalism lives or Mother Earth lives. Of course, brothers and sisters, we are here for life, for humanity, and for the rights of Mother Earth. Long live the rights of Mother Earth, death to capitalism." And I have to say, this language thrills me. When he speaks of the need to live well rather than live better as defined by capitalism, I feel the vivifying presence of that utopian dream of a liberated and emancipated reality that for me was the best part of the 60s. Would that there could be a movement that would capture that again.
Not to me?
No.
Not to me?
I did tell Osha that I would not back him up in screaming, "That's bullshit and you know it." That was a motherfucker scream. I first heard it in 1968 in March of 68 at the SDS regional, or not convention, what was it called? Every three months. What was that called?
The National Committee.
Well, it was the National Committee, but it was a gathering.
Right, it was
gathering.
Was a conference.
And the motherfuckers were there. And anytime anybody would say something that they disagree with, they'd stand up in the audience and scream, "That's bullshit and you know it." You know, and I couldn't understand, but I liked the "you know it" part. I thought that was absolutely hilarious. So, anyway, I will back him up, though, on one thing. This book is a remarkable book. And may I just sort of, it's in two parts. The first part is the story of the motherfuckers, which is an interesting story, actually. And when people start behaving, believing in anarchism, and then behaving anarchistically as an organizing project, some strange things happen. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah.
And that's the first half. And
strange and wonderful.
I recommend this to all my friends who are anarchists to read it. Then the second half is even more unique. It's a meditation, a dialogue, a reflection with his two fathers. One father is a guy by the name of Franz Neumann. These were all the generation of 38. But they came to the United States from a place called Frankfurt. They were of the Frankfurt School. And so Osha grew
Wait,
up...
My other father?
I'm going to get to him. So Osha grew up in a family that knew Theodore Adorno personally. He was Uncle Ted. And his other father was a guy by the name of Herbert Marcuse. You may or may not have heard of this guy. But
how many people have heard of him?
Oh, my.
Hey!
You don't find too many audiences.
All right.
And so what Tommy does is in the second half of this book, he carries on a reflection, a dialogue with these two guys over the problem of theory versus practice. And I really, really, really do recommend.
You know, I'm glad you like the second part. I mean, a lot of people just sort of.
Well, it was unreadable. It's absolutely unreadable because he was doing it in their language.
I don't know, but
that's sort of like seeing a dinosaur walk or something. That's cool. That's cool. So if you want to check out a present-day Frankfurt School Marcusean debate, check out Osha's book. I'm not lying about this. Now, before I got into, I want to get into my remarks. I want to remark a little bit about this building. This is absolutely phenomenal. This and just, you know, we don't have these things in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We really don't. This is represents the concentration of capital in the late 19th century. And they, some people named Rockefeller put it all together, and here it is. And I am amazed at the crap that the present day owners of this country and the world come up with architecturally compared to this good shit, you know? Because, you know, the stuff that they're producing now is terrible. I mean, it just, you don't see a Bill Gates. You know, if you had a Bill Gates house, it would probably have a lot of sheetrock in it, you know? So, anyway, this is the real thing. This is capital, crystallized. Okay, now, about these questions that Spencer asked, I think they're all great questions, and I want to make just one comment and then leave it and go on to what I'm thinking about now.
Damn, but it'll be good.
Isaac Deutscher. I was reading a book by Tariq Ali, which he wrote in 2001, called "Conflict of Fundamentalism." Does anybody remember the title?
Clash of Fundamentalism.
At the end, he has an amazing. He was a Tariq Ali was one of the editors of New Left Review, which is still around, and Tariq Ali is still around. He's very cool. So at the end, he includes an amazing interview he held in 1967 with Isaac Deutscher. Now, it was right before Deutscher died. Now, Isaac Deutscher was the biographer of Trotsky. Cool. And three volumes. And he also knew a hell of a lot about Stalin. And he also knew about the course of the communist movement. You know, so like Isaac Deutscher was one of our great intellectuals who was still alive when we were children. And in the interview, he says, 67, right after the June War, he says, Deutscher also wrote a brilliant book called The Non-Jewish Jew. If anybody gets a chance to get the non-Jewish Jew, do. Because Deutscher himself was raised to be a rabbi. Deutscher became a rabbi before he was bar mitzvah. I'm not making this up. So Deutscher was the real thing. So Deutscher says, you're making a mistake. The New Left is making a mistake. If it thinks that U.S. imperialism is spent. The military defeat, everybody could see it. That was 1967. The defeat didn't come till 75. But we knew it was coming because we'd been studying the war. And the whole left knew the defeat was coming. And he said, the defeat does not represent the fall of imperialism. It will be very strong. And this was actually in contradiction to the line that we were getting from Cuba and from Che, which was 2-3 many Vietnams is a strategy to victory. So we all, I don't know anybody, but you know, Osha and I, we're of this tendency to say, okay, 2-3 many Vietnams, let's do it. And Deutscher said, just look at the strength of the United States in Indonesia. 1964, 3 years before, the U.S. pulled off a military coup in Indonesia in which they killed 1 million people in 64. And we didn't have our eyes on that. We had our eyes on this military defeat in Vietnam, and that's what informed us, but we weren't seeing the whole thing. And he was saying the revolution isn't here. U.S. imperialism is pretty strong, and is very strong, and I think that he was right. Deutscher was right, and the New Left was wrong, thinking that the end was coming. So you asked the question, what were the conditions, right? Well, the conditions were we thought world revolution was imminent and that the defeat in Vietnam was the beginning. And we didn't want to just stand on the side and applaud. We wanted to get it on. So if you want to know, that's it. Now, the crazier parts of it are also obvious, which is that when you realize at an emotional as well as an intellectual level that your country is killing to 5 million people, is murdering committing that level of murder, it's not easy to know what the exact right thing to do is. Of course, that would absolve a lot of crimes under there. So it doesn't mean that you don't look at the problems and the mistakes. In fact, I wrote a book about the problems and the mistakes. It's called Underground, and it covers 1965 to 1977, and I'm going to be very brief about that, and then I want to get into what I really want to talk about. The book is about fairly good organizing at Columbia University, but it's only Columbia University, you know, but it's not that hard to organize at Columbia University, but it's real organizing. And I got there in 65 and learned it from the Red Diaper Babies who were into it already. And it was good organizing, and it paid off after 3 years, and we had this big rebellion. That's the first part of the book. Then the second part of the book is how we took that experience and perverted it and thought, aha, we learned the wrong lesson. The lesson we learned was audacity, militancy will gain you support. And this was exactly an application of Che's FOCO theory. So it's not like we were just these dumb kids who were very impatient. Oops, 2 minutes. Okay, so we're not like just these dumb kids who were very impatient, but we also had a theory. And the theory came from Che, the FOCO theory. I won't go into it. You all know it. Regis Debray, blah, blah, blah. We can talk about that later. So we adopted the FOCO theory and said, let's get it on. So we went from good organizing to bad organizing in something called Weatherman, which was my faction of SDS. I was the last national secretary of SDS, and I was involved in a decision to destroy the largest radical student organization, 100,000 members at the height of the war. I did the work of the FBI for them. And why I did it was not because they paid me, they never paid me a cent, but I did it because I thought I had a better idea. My better idea was guerrilla warfare. So that's the third part of the book, which I sort of didn't participate that much with guerrilla warfare. I got out of it as quick as I could because it was stupid and losing. But if I had a working title for my book, it was, in my head, Idealism and Its Discontents. And if anybody wants to talk about intellectual idealism on the left or idealism in any form, we could do that. Now, I want to get into the stuff I really want to talk about, which is what is to be done now, right? I've been going around. Yesterday, a student at Drake University asked me, what's left of the 60s? What's good about the 60s? Just, you know, it's a good school, Drake University. It's another dinosaur. It's a liberal arts college. Very rare, very rare. Believe me, I live in New Mexico, and there's no liberal arts. It doesn't exist. Those of you in liberal arts schools, it's a blessing. But Drake University is a survivor. It's a liberal arts school. And this kid asked me, well, what's left? And I said, movements. Movements, the development of mass movements, the experience of mass movements, the anti-war movement, its predecessor, the civil rights movement. And I could talk about the importance of civil rights to our consciousness as white kids, but we learned how to organize. So if there's one thing, anyway, what we need now, I could talk about the importance of the civil rights movement in terms of our practice now, but what we really need is people, young people, yourselves, who are committed to organizing. Organizing is a practice of growing the movement strategically. It's very difficult. It's easier to talk about it than to do it. At the age of 63, I'm tired. I'm tired of organizing. I've been organizing my whole life, and I'm still doing it, and I'm still tired. It's up to you guys to learn how to organize. And the best way to learn how to organize is to study SNCC in the South, because SNCC is the gold standard. SNCC is the greatest story of the 20th century. It's where a bunch of students, black students from small black colleges, historically black colleges of the South, asked the question of their elders, where's the roughest part of the South? Where's the most terroristic place in the South? Where are the people the most oppressed? Mississippi, the Delta region. And they went into these 9 or 11 counties where no black people ever voted, and where the system was kept in place by violence, by terror, by murder. I'm not making any of this up. And the people were three-quarters of them did not own their own homes. They didn't have jobs except on plantations. They had nothing. The black middle class was minuscule. It was minuscule. They were in, like, one step up from slavery. SDS went there. Fuck. SNCC went there. It wasn't SDS. SNCC went there. No, but SDS learned from them. SNCC went there, and they used the technique of organizing that was brought by Ella Jo Baker. So study the life of Ella Jo Baker. You've all heard of Martin Luther King. Ella Jo Baker was the person who did the organizing. Martin Luther King was up there making speeches. Cool, that's it. Mobilizations. Ella Baker taught the young people of SNCC how to organize. There's a book on this, Charles M. Payne, I've Got the Light of Freedom. Isn't he at University of Chicago? Charles M. Payne? Yes. Isn't he a sociologist here? Yeah, Charles M. Payne is a sociologist here. He has written the most brilliant book on organizing ever written. It's called I've Got the Light of Freedom. You should bring him in as a speaker. You should read his book because he talks about the method. It's a method. It's an organizing tradition. And it comes down from black churches, rural black churches, via women. Anyway, here's my point. Young people now say, what can we do? They've got no, they're hopeless. They've never seen movements. They don't, but if they've seen or heard or read about movements, they don't know how to organize. The method is there. We got to learn from the people of the 20th century who used it successfully. And there's many more right now all around the world who are using it successfully. We could talk about them. But we have it in our own country, this untold story, this untold experience. I learned organizing from red diaper babies who had learned it by growing up with people in the labor movement and the civil rights movement. Now it's your turn to learn organizing, because what we've got to do is organize. And what we're organizing for is a complete and total progressive movement. And my goal is social democracy. I'm a European-style social democrat. I think that we have to have a society with a little more compassion, a lot less militarism, and narrow the gaps and take off the worst edges of capitalism. And the best I can think of in the real world is European social democracy, and I think that's our goal. And the way to it is to turn the Democratic Party into a party of the people. Make it a party that represents the opposite pole from capital. Now, I know everybody says, you can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it. But we got to do it. There's no alternative. You've got a better strategy. Let me hear it. And the way we can do this is through community organizing, because we can build a base among the wretched of this country, who are the half of the population who don't vote. They are the disenfranchised. They are the people like in the Mississippi Delta who have been cut out, completely, totally cut out from politics. They are out of it. They are out of everything. They've given up hope. We need community organizing to build this movement. So I brought two books I want to mention. They both have red covers, which is coincidental. One is Tom Hayden's The Long 60s, and in it, he does a brilliant introduction in which he lays out a theory of movement building. I cannot recommend this book enough. And then the rest of the book, okay, I'm finishing. The rest of the book, I'm going to go really fast now. The rest of the book is a 200-page explication of his 50 years in the movement, including the civil rights movement and founding SDS and a lot of other really great stuff that in which he explains how movements get built and what organizing is. Then the other book is a totally liberal book. I told you I was going to be the only liberal on the panel. It's by a guy named Ari Berman, who's 28 years old. It's about the mass movement, the development of a mass-based movement within the Democratic Party. And that is my goal, and I want a realignment of the Democratic Party. And this is called Herding Donkeys. It starts in 04, and it goes through 2010. And it takes up the errors of Obama in letting the movement go. I'm an Obama supporter, incidentally. So thank you very much. I'm sorry I went over. And if anybody wants to talk about the past or anything else, I'll be around.
And read his book also. It's really very good.
Mark, you're not the only liberal on this panel.
Are we fighting?
However, I intend to give a considerably, I think, considerably different emphasis on discussing the 60s, and that an emphasis that suggests that in addition to organizing, it's necessary to think. Now, I entered socialist politics in the 1950s. This is why I have a somewhat different way of looking at things. It was a dark world, and there were not many of us young socialists. The Cold War dominated politics. My father, whose circles of friends were from in and around the Communist Party, people like Paul Robeson and Harry Bridges, and these were all people that he knew, and Howard Fast, and writers, worked for the United States government. And he he was subject to a security investigation started by Truman in 1948, and by 1952, he was actually dismissed from the government. So for four years, while I was out there going to school, one thing and another, this huge cloud hung over our family. I was searching for some way out of the polarized world of the Cold War. I felt the U.S. stifled civil liberties at home and supported reactionary governments abroad, such as Franco Spain. People forget about Franco Spain, but we must remember. Yet I rejected the oppressive totalitarian regimes of the so-called socialist states. And so, quite logically it seemed to me, I joined the Young Socialist League, led by Mike Harrington, who you may have heard of, and affiliated with Max Shackman. Then I became National Secretary of the Young Socialist Alliance, affiliated with Jim Cannon's Socialist Workers' Party, a Trotskyist, part of the old left to be sure, but a dissident part, and I was young to boot. What did we believe? I could sum it up in three notions, which I now see as the good, the bad, and the ugly. I will start with the good. We Trotskyists held that so-called real existing socialism was actually a society ruled by a bureaucratic elite with a poorly functioning command economy, an undemocratic one-party political system, and an all-pervasive secret police. We saw these essential features not only in the USSR, but in East Europe, China, and North Vietnam. We have been proven right in this assessment. On to the bad. Our vision of the future was based on the past. We projected our idealized vision of what had happened in the 1930s on the future. Once a new economic crisis developed, the working class would become radicalized, opening up revolutionary opportunities for us. There was nothing particularly evil about this vision. It was just plain wrong. Not only did the apocalypse not take place on schedule, but today, as we suffer the worst economic crisis since the 30s, we find the left paralyzed and in retreat. The anger of the people has been captured by the extreme Tea Party right. Finally, the ugly. We saw ourselves as a chosen few, the professional revolutionaries organized in a disciplined combat party whose program held the key to the victory of the working class. In this sense, we remained communists. We were not alone in holding this view. This vanguardist notion has led to the splintering of both Trotskyist and Maoist sects, and in many cases, their transformation into cults. The 60s exploded on the scene in a way none of us could have predicted. The heart of this explosion was the struggle against the Vietnam War and the parallel struggle, largely outside the new left sphere of influence, of the civil rights movement. I do believe our early work in spreading socialist ideas on campus and the role of the YSA in the latter portion of the 60s leading the mass anti-war marches, which, by the way, SDS abandoned, were important. Yet it seemed at the time, and equally 50 years later, that the student movement went on its own chaotic, fitful, radical way. And the SDS was the very center of it all. Our notions, the good, the bad, and ugly, fell on deaf ears. The new left rejected the old left, but did not negate it. They were simply not interested in theoretically understanding the states that in those days covered a third of the Earth's surface. SDS did have some ideas of its own. Perhaps the most important was this notion of participatory democracy, a form of self-government and decentralized organization based on reaching consensus. This worked quite well on the local level, fitting the mood of students and providing just a modicum of organization needed for local protest. However, it never worked on a national level. By 1968, the SDS national leadership found itself facing the invasion of the Progressive Labor Party body snatchers. I remember a young woman getting up at one of these conferences and speaking in a sing-song fashion. We must ally with the workers and not the liberals. I have been working in this factory for the last 3 weeks, and all the workers agree we must break with the liberals and fight for socialism. That was Progressive Labor. In reaction to this invasion of non-PLP forces, the non-PLP forces broke into warring Maoist factions, RIM 1, the Weathermen, RIM 2, Klonsky, Avakian, and later Line of March, Marlene Dixon's Democratic Workers Party, and several other groups. These groups rejected the good, tending to be more Stalinist than mainstream communists, while embracing the bad and the ugly. Yet radical students were correct to search for a road out of the student ghetto into mainstream America. Students do eventually graduate. I know it comes as a shock to you, but it happens. More important, we all shared a common vision of a socialist future, and we knew students alone were incapable of bringing this future into fruition. The question then, and still is now, how? And what, you may impolitely ask, was I doing while all this was going on? Precious little of import. Yet I remember it was very exhausting. You try to do little of import and it can really wear you out. I was off in my own sect with our particular interpretation of the Marxist Seven Seals and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Of course, we were there at all marches and civil rights demos and all conferences. Our growth came in the aftermath of the breakup of SDS. We recruited our share of those searching souls, deserted, they felt, by SDS. With these new forces, we tried something different. We won over some minority students from community colleges. Together with our white student members, they entered the poorest minority areas in New York and other cities. We won over high school students from Jefferson High in East New York, schools in the Bronx and elsewhere. These kids then recruited other, less political young people. We held dances, played basketball, and yes, lectured them on dialectics. It's a weird combination, but we really did do it. At one point, we held a youth conference in New York City attended by 500 minority youth. We brought these kids with us into anti-war activities. For a while it worked, but only for a while. The promised labor upsurge did not take place, and they, one by one, dropped out. It was an exciting time, dangerous. Some of our comrades were shot at, one stabbed, but we believed, they believed. It was our bubble within the bubble that was the 60s. I want to touch just briefly on the civil rights struggle. The old and new left had precisely little to do with this movement, preciously little to do with this movement. The struggle emerged from the black masses themselves, and it was led by two groups, the black ministers and the southern black students. It was a struggle won, and America has never been the same since. I should point out, in agreeing with Mark on SNCC, but to add to it the fact that one of the reasons why SNCC worked is that it came out of a movement. It didn't try to create a movement out of nothing. When SDS went into the white neighborhoods in, through what it called ERAP, and tried to organize the white poor, when there was not yet a white poor movement, it utterly failed. Since, however, SNCC, for all its, however, SNCC, for all its great work, did not produce a continuing organization. Stokely Carmichael turned to black power, and then black nationalism made the group prey to sex, to isolation, and in the end, to demise. The political black political struggle, of course, survived. It returned in more traditional forms, Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, and now Obama. Much the same could be said for the so-called Cultural Revolution. Human relations have been changed, and a youth culture persists, but the utopian communities, the communes, collapsed. I like to look at the 60s as a bubble in history. Everything was possible in the moment, and miraculous events took place. I am particularly thinking of the plant occupations in France, the mass marches here, the Prague Spring. Those of us who occupied that bubble quite naturally projected this magic into an indefinite future. However, the abnormal is always followed by the normal. What lasts from the one into the other are changes in human relations and institutions, for example, civil rights, and parties geared to the long haul. I do believe we had the opportunity to build a relatively large and sustainable socialist political party in the early 70s, perhaps more reformist than revolutionary, a bit messy, diverse in our thinking, both connected to and separated from the Democratic Party. But we flubbed it, all of us.
I got a book, too. It's about Marxism, but I got a special, I got a tie-in deal now with Hollywood. We got Brad Pitt. He's going to play Marx. We got Matt Damon's going to be Engels. We got Angelina lined up to do Rosa Luxemburg. We got a tie-in with McDonald's, a Happy Meal. We got little action figures. We got it all covered. Kanye's going to do the music soundtrack for the movie. It's going to be based on Gil Scott-Heron's old song. It's going to be "The Revolution Will Not Be on Facebook. The Revolution Will Not Be Twittered." But in any case, the highest compliment anyone can give anybody is to fight with them. Really. The biggest insult you can give somebody is to be patronizing, is to pat them on the head, is to sing kumbaya when you know you disagree. If you're willing to risk losing somebody's friendship because you feel it's important to say what you need to say, that's actually the greatest respect you can give somebody. And the most dangerous thing that anybody can do is to believe something because it makes you feel good. It's okay to do things that make you feel good, usually, but you have to be careful about thinking something that makes you feel good, because if you start believing things because they make you feel good, then whoever can make you feel good will have you dancing around on the end of a string. They will own you. That's the problem with the religious right. Not that these people are dedicating their life to God, but because they're dedicating their life to somebody who's pulling the strings, some human. Well, we have to ask ourselves the same question. Are we believing something because it makes us feel good, or are we believing something because it's based on objective reality, with an understanding that objective reality is always changing and our perceptions of it are always limited? We all know that. I don't want to go over that again. But nevertheless, there's a reality that's strong enough for us to stand on, strong enough for us to at least jump to the next step, like some helpless frog on a 1980s video game, hoping that at least we can get to the next log before the other one passes away. And there is such a thing as progress. People tend to believe that the world revolves around them. If there's one common thread, perhaps the only common thread in all of our four talks, is the understanding that the world does not revolve around our own individual selves. And I think that's very important. But I think that for students, whether in the 1960s, the 70s, or today, there's a tendency to believe that social change would come from, oh my God, from the students. How convenient. I'm a student, and I'm an intellectual, and I'm a working class person. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. Gee, I don't know. Maybe there's a new working class. Well, whatever it is, I'm the center of the world. I deal with sociologists. They act like that all the time. I think they got it down perfectly. On the one hand, they can hobnob with the intellectuals and rub shoulders with them because, hey, you know, they understand the difference between Louis Vuitton and Louis Althusser or something. On the other hand, they also can feel like they're doing good in the world. I don't want to be too contemptuous because I think there are two kinds of liberals, and I think a lot of people are guided by a sense of humanism and wanting to serve people, and I think that's basically a good thing, whether or not we agree or not on fundamental core issues. But the idea was that the working class was going to disappear, or that it was weak and helpless or stupid or something. But the big news is it didn't disappear, actually. Not just the old-fashioned floor, but the fairly modern chairs you're sitting in were still built by workers somewhere. The difference was the globalization, imperialism, which means that now major parts of the working class are 15-year-old girls in Guatemala making the shirts that you're wearing, or 18-year-old girls in Taiwan making the computers that intellectuals type on while they talk about how there's no working class anymore. So the world is very complicated. But I would just like to toss one other little framework caveat out. This old joke, a really old joke about, there was a sort of racist TV show when we were kids about the Lone Ranger, and he had this Native American partner named Tonto, I don't know. Anyway, but the standard joke went like this when the Lone Ranger says to his, quote, Indian friend, "We're surrounded, what do we do?" And the assistant, the Indian, says to him, "What do you mean we?" And I think that we have to be careful about we. Those of us who are talking about the left are talking about it from our own individual perspectives. There was a huge left. Now, probably the common thing we're talking about here is the white campus left. And maybe that should have been what the subject was, the way the subject was framed. And that was an important movement. It would take volumes and volumes to talk about the black liberation movement, the struggle against racism, and various other aspects that were predominant in the 1960s. And the labor movement, by the way, we can poo-poo it, but the National Guard had to be called out against the postal workers. General Motors and General Electric workers went on strike during the war while the president was screaming at them and telling them that they were hurting the war effort, and they struck anyway. And, of course, the urban rebellions, the 250 cities that went up in flames, was, after all, led mainly by workers. They did studies on who the rebels were. They weren't 18-year-old kids strung out on crack. The average age was 20, 25, 27, and most of them had jobs. You know, so the reality is more complicated, I think, than stereotypes. And we really want to be careful about romanticizing the situation so that we put ourselves conveniently in the middle of everything so that we appear to be the heroes. One of your historians, wonderful, wonderful writer from the University of Chicago, John Hope Franklin, before he died, he was interviewed on the radio, and the interviewer said to him, "I guess as you get older, you kind of, you know, you develop a sense of perspective, a sense of history, you know, you mellow out a little bit, you kind of become more patient when you understand the long run of history." And Franklin said into the microphone, "Hell no, the older I get, the more impatient I get. My mom told me that when I was 20, I would change." Okay, well, when you're 25, you'll change. Well, where do you get kids? Well, where do you have a job? Well, where did this... I don't want to disappoint anybody, but I ain't changed at all. I don't renounce a thing that I ever did. I can be self-critical about some of what I did, but I don't renounce any of it. And I'm not tired, actually. I'm not tired because I didn't have those kind of expectations in the 1960s. My path, if we want to talk about that, you know, I think it was a combination of things. But I think it was optimism combined with when you lie to somebody and you lie to them and you lie to them and you lie to them, that's what makes people snap. And that's, I think, what turned liberals into radicals in the 1960s. It was being lied to again and again and again. In an indirect way, maybe one of the more profound books was an utterly non-political Catcher in the Rye with Holden Caulfield, which I read a dozen times, had no idea what the hell it was about, and I kept on rereading it. I still didn't understand. I just knew somehow or some way it was speaking some truth to me, but I still didn't know what the point of it was. You know, there were no cliff notes. I couldn't figure it out. There was no internet. I couldn't read some professor's notes from University of California, Los Angeles, to find out how he interpreted it. There was none of that. I didn't know what it was, but I realized years later he was just talking about the phoniness, the lies. And the lie was that here we were in the U.S. of A., the greatest, most wonderful nation in the world, and dogs were biting people who were trying to vote, and the government was dropping bombs, and people were being burned alive in their skin, and they were lying and lying, and they were not even good liars, and we caught them in their lies again and again, and after a while, it was kind of like, you know, when someone lies to you enough times, they don't exist anymore. They just don't exist. It's like, you know, like if your boyfriend or your girlfriend lies to you enough times, after a while you say, okay, which Ricky is this? Is this the Ricky who says that, or is it the Ricky who says, I don't know, whatever. I don't even know what Ricky is. I don't know what America is anymore. We didn't know what America was anymore. All we knew was that we had to stop the damn war, and we had to do something to stop the massive, massive crush of racism. The old left, I think the old left did more in the civil rights movement than people realized, but they did it in indirect ways. And they were superseded pretty quickly by the middle 1960s, because generally speaking, most of the old left played a conservative role, conservative in terms of action, compared to what most of us were trying to do. On my own particular path, I really don't want to talk about myself, but I was at the University of Wisconsin. My girlfriend badgered me, no pun intended, into going there. I really didn't mean that, I swear. Into going there. She wasn't going there, but she badgered me to go in there. And it was an incredible experience in the 1960s, astounding. And I started out majoring in physics, and after getting on academic probation, I knew that I had to put myself into the struggle to end the war. I didn't care about anything else. So I got my bachelor's in philosophy because she needed the fewest credits for that. I was on academic probation until the semester before I graduated. And we did everything from blocking draft boards to trying to shut down Dow Chemical, and doing everything we could to stop the war. Okay, well, 2 minutes. Okay, this is going to be fast. Good thing I took some methamphetamines from Indiana, so I'll be able to talk about that. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, so, but seriously, when I graduated, I knew I had to work full-time for the movement. So I moved to Boston, became a traveling organizer for SDS. And I worked with a lot of people, including I worked with PLP. And I'll say flat out that there were, you know, none of these groups are as monolithic as everybody thinks. There were all kinds of people in all these groups, some of whom were very mechanical and some of whom weren't, you know. But what I saw in SDS was an incredible amount of confusion. Burned into my memory was one situation at an SDS convention in 1968 when one group got up, led by the up-against-the-wall motherfuckers who denounced PLP as being Stalinist, and all of the national office people applauded. And then someone from the national office got up and quoted from Stalin and talked about how PLP was betraying Stalin's true message. And I did, in fact, see some members of the up-against-the-wall...
I didn't get that. The people from the national office said what?
No, Steve Halliwell and a number of other people denounced PLP for not adhering to Stalin's line of the national question or something like that. And I saw the anarchists getting up and applauding. And at that point, I said to myself, there's something really unprincipled going on here, you know, which isn't to say that PLP walked on water either in those days. But I think it's too easy to resort to the kind of stereotypes that might appeal to young people today, stereotypes about robots invading and all that other stuff. It was a movement, it was a struggle. People of all different political persuasions were using anything they could to fight to bring this system down. So I traveled. And the movement that I saw is not the same, I think, as the movement some of the people here on the panel with me saw. We all saw different pieces of it. But I traveled to dozens and dozens of campuses, and I saw it was mostly working class people, in fact, in the movement. We had sit-ins. We blocked army recruiters. You don't know what fear is until you've been stopped at 2 o'clock in the morning by police in a completely abandoned area of Flint, Michigan. And they say, open the trunk. And you open the trunk, and there's a copy of, well, after the SDS split, we tried to keep SDS going for a while, but it was very hard. And there was a newspaper that had on the front cover of it a picture of Black Panther Party people in a shootout with the police, and a headline that said, "People have a right to defend themselves from the police." So the cops, the three of them are standing around there, and they take this out of the trunk, and they're looking at me. And I was going to say something like, yeah, somebody gave me that. But the problem was I had 4,000 copies of it in the trunk of my car. So it was a little bit hard, but I think they were messing with me. In any case, let me summarize, because I guess I'm running out here. I think that if we want to talk about the decline of that movement, I think there were five things. First, I think that the world left movement. I have no problem with the word communist because Marx had no problem with it. He didn't call it the Socialist Manifesto. He didn't call it the Social Democratic Manifesto. He didn't call it the Liberal Manifesto. So I kind of like it. I was a utopian communist. I think most people in the world are. But I wasn't really political when I was young. But I think that the left is in much worse shape than people realize. That is, the revolutionary left is. I have no hope for the reformist left. I think that the process of capitalism lead to fascism and rivers of blood. Rivers of blood. And I don't think there's a way to avoid that. I wish there was a way to avoid it, but there's no way to avoid it. I don't hope for it. I'm not trying to bring it on. I'm just telling you that anybody that thinks you can cross that river of blood without getting blood doesn't understand history. So I do think that we have to face that, and I think that the world left movement actually began its decline probably in the 1950s. And it had that burst in the 60s of optimism. But now we see Vietnam welcoming Walmart and China welcoming Walmart. And as a world movement, it's weak. There are scattered movements here and there that show some positive hope. But I'm not particularly optimistic about Evo Morales or Hugo Chavez either at this point. The second thing that really hurt the movement, I think, was that any process, when it reaches a limit, has to either transform or be twisted and distorted. And the movement had reached, the white campus movement had reached its limit by 1968-69. It had to reach out to the working class. When I say working class, a lot of people never understood what that word meant. It didn't mean Archie Bunker and let's tell a white worker we want to give him money. It meant reaching out to the community as a whole, much of which was Black and Latino, by the way. The failure to do that, the failure to fight racism, the giving in to separatism really, really hurt. Third, of course, was drugs. The culture, you know, Woodstock actually hurt the movement. The Beatles tailed the movement. They didn't build the movement. It weakened it. The bosses found a way to give in on that. Fourth was probably the elections, defeat of Nixon, and the illusory feeling that people had power in this country. And fifth, okay, give me 30 seconds, I swear I'll stop. And the fifth was, I would say, was the, you know, with all due respect to Marx's self-criticism, the devastating impact of the Weather Underground on the movement cannot ever be overestimated in terms of the impact that it had. To go to a group of steelworkers in Pittsburgh and try and pass out a leaflet to them about why they should oppose the war, the day after some woman from the Weather Underground took her blouse off and ran through the high school saying, "Free yourselves, free yourselves." Or thank God that nail bomb didn't go off at Fort Dix. Because if it had gone off at Fort Dix and they would have dragged the bodies of dead women out and dead men out, we wouldn't have to worry about police repression against us. The masses of the United States would have beat the crap out of us anytime, went anywhere. So I would just say that the movie with the worst title and the best movie ever, the ratio of good movie to bad title, was the most rented DVD of all time, and that's The Shawshank Redemption. Because there, he waited and he waited, but he wasn't waiting, he was planning. Marx's old mole. You don't have to choose between running and hiding and turning the other cheek versus standing out there as a martyr. You can also just take your shot, build a movement. There's a lot going on today. I haven't changed at all. We're building a movement on my campus. We make so many mistakes, I couldn't even recount them. But we're involved in everything from opposing police brutality. Four of my recent students are high school teachers in the inner city now, trying to work with youth. It's possible to build a movement, but we really need to have a long-term view. We can't believe the revolution is going to happen tomorrow. We have to expect to take some losses, and we should never think the world revolves around us. But never for a minute give up the understanding that the system does have to come down. It does have to come down, and it's not going to come down through elections and through countercultural institutions. But it's also not going to come down through terrorism. So there's no easy way out of it, but it's a long struggle. And I'll stop now.
That's all relative. The older you are, the more you want to talk, right?
What I wanted to say is that I think it's clear from this panel that people that participated in the 60s have drawn, to some degree, different lessons from that experience. So all I can do is point out what lessons, the central lesson that I drew from it. And that central lesson was that we are living, that to devote your political activity to the idea of creating a revolution which is not on the agenda, which is not on the agenda in this country for the foreseeable future, is to take talented people, good people, thoughtful people, and put them in a blind alley. What we need to confront is the fact, which is historically proven, that change does take place. The United States has changed, and it's continuing to change. But this change is not spectacular revolution. The change, though some of it has been, the change is primarily incremental. And if we're, and the second point, and this is something that's funny, we attacked the old left, and I used to be certainly constantly attacking the American Communist Party. But the American Communist Party, in its best days, did recognize that there's not necessarily a contradiction between favoring a alternative to capitalism and acting in the actual political processes of the working class, and that workers will have not turned to or be interested in socialism or socialists unless those socialists are people who actually fight to make a change in their real life, not what came. I want to end on this one point because I think it summarizes the whole thing. It's a little incident. As perhaps you may or may not know, Vanessa Redgrave, who my personal opinion is one of the greatest actresses of all time, was and probably still is a Trotskyist. And at one point, she was very active in running around. And there was a point, and you know, her daughter was Natasha Richardson, who has sadly died before the mother. But at one point, when Natasha was a little girl, Vanessa went in to say goodnight to her, and Natasha says, "You're never here for me. Where are you? When I need you, you're not here." And she says, "Well, that's because I am out there seeing that all the little girls in the world are going to have a better life. But what about me?" she said.
Well, Ken, you are a red diaper baby. Is that right?
Tim. My name's Tim.
Tim, right. You are a red diaper baby.
I am sort of a pinkish diaper baby.
You ended by talking about a problem of children of leftists, a major problem. I would say that my kids would relate to that story, too. I wanted to comment on two points that Alan made, though. both of which I couldn't agree with more. The first is the impact of the weather underground. I said I thought we were doing the work of the FBI for them. That realization has reverberated in my mind for the last 40 years or so. And to live with that consciousness, to live with that realization, I agree with him. I think we fucked up the movement really bad in a lot of ways. And I, you know, some people say, "Well, you guys take, you know, it's the same old egotism. You take too much credit. The movement was going to die of its own." But no, I there's a lot of ways I could talk about that to corroborate your point. And I could, and that was a very telling example you gave. And there were literally hundreds more. And you can get a few of them in my book if you're interested. But I don't think that's being repeated now very much. I don't think people are picking up the gun too much. There's a little bit of that in the environmental movement, and the government exploits it quite well. The Green Scare. There's even you probably know this, but there's even a law, a federal law called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism, Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And they define terrorism as $10,000 or more dollars of damage to any enterprise, governmental or private, that deals with animals. So if you have even, right now as we talk, six people are in prison for organizing a boycott, a secondary boycott, which is a traditional nonviolent tactic, of companies that deal with certain labs, the hunting labs. So anything at all that the government that we give them, they will take, and they do. And even obviously a secondary boycott is a nonviolent tactic, but they're still going to call it terrorism. But let's not give them too much ammunition. The other thing that I could talk for quite a while on nonviolence versus violence. The other thing that Alan said, though, was worse even than that. I mean, deeper. He predicted rivers of blood as a consequence of this crisis. And I couldn't agree with him more. And the reason is that the United States is set up for war. Noam Chomsky says the goal of the United States is global domination through the use of violence. He used to say the goal of the United States was global domination. Now he's added through the use of violence, meaning war is the goal, it's not the means. That's a big change when you realize, and it's monstrous to believe that all these the purpose of these wars and continual wars, Tom Hayden predicts the long war. That's one of the other things he talks about is the long war. It's not in this book, but in another one. No, it's war. So what I found in a lot of college campuses, especially where I live in New Mexico, a lot of really smart, the smartest people, young people, are doing things like growing organic gardens and getting ready for the crisis. And they're figuring out some kind of positive response to the crisis. And they're right, in a way. We need a positive response. We need an alternative to this food system. They're absolutely right. I don't want them to stop doing that. But they're predicting a collapse to which they have a solution, you know, alternative energy, alternative food. But long before it gets to that collapse, it's going to be war. And a lot of it. That was how that's how fascism does it. That's how capitalism does it, war. And that's what we're set up for. So the question then is, what should we spend our time doing? Should we do organic farms, which I think is good, but somebody should get organizing to organize a mass movement for political power, because that's the only logical alternative other than the rivers of blood. And so we're at a crisis situation now. It's an ecological crisis. It's a crisis of energy. It's a crisis of the planet. It's a crisis of a million things. It's a real estate crisis. It's everything. You know, my friend Arnum Johnson from, if anybody wants to know about Columbia University, Hamilton Hall, Student Afro-American Society, Arnum Johnson of South Shore, my friend took me, he was at Hamilton Hall in 1968, and that's the untold story of Columbia, the one that, that really needs to get told. It's actually not been not untold. Stefan Bradley, a young professor of history, has written a brilliant book called Harlem versus Columbia about that strike. But anyway, Arnum took me on a tour of Chicago today. And it's there are certain parts of Chicago, obviously, that have been rebuilt, but there are certain parts of Chicago that are hurting because it's post-industrial times still. And they have been devastated on the west side. And the question is, I mean, there's so many crises. There's so much happening. Well, people can get demoralized and say, nothing we do can ever make a difference. But what I'm trying to say is, in the past, there have always been social and political mass movements, and they've always been built by self-conscious organizers. So let's get organizing. And probably what we should have is schools of organizing at universities so people come out as organizers rather than as investment bankers or whatever the stupid shit they're going into.
I have no idea what we're supposed to be doing now. I mean, I think we have to do it all, and I don't know that any of it is going to be worth it. I mean, I've heard Tim and Mark talk about organizing, about the long haul. Alan talked about the long haul. Mark talked about, you know, sort of more reformist than revolutionary. I mean, it's all fine, but I just don't know whether it's going to do it. I mean, there's lots of, I mean, the SNCC model, it's again like, you know, going and taking a model. Well, it was, is that in fact actually what it's going to be like to organize? There's actually another story of organizing, somewhat more, you know, less heroic, which is in Barack Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, about organizing here in Chicago. And it has a decidedly downbeat ending to it. I mean, lots and lots of going door to door and nothing much happening. I also, you know, this balance between the long haul, it's what I call about freedom, shouting freedom now and freedom not quite yet. I still don't think we've quite got that down. Yes, it has to be the long haul, but this idea that politics, like, and we don't even think of evolution this way, is sort of a long, gradual process. We now know that there are leaps, and I think that there are breaks, there are moments of enlightenment, unexpected breakthroughs, and utopian vision, and I am not prepared to get rid of that utopian element of the revolution. I think even if you're working practically in the movement, that is going to be there. And I was struck also by the rivers of blood because it reminded me again of how in the 60s these metaphors of violence and suddenly all of a sudden all the energy goes towards the rivers of blood. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of blood, but I don't know if it's going to be here in the United States. I mean, I think rather there's another possibility, in some way a more negative possibility of an erosion. And then I don't know how the rivers of blood fit into the idea that, you know, can one really imagine a movement, a transformation of the United States outside of the electoral process? I don't think I can, you know, but does other kinds of actions, sometimes bloody, feed into that? Yeah, maybe. So I don't know. I mean, I will tell you just something from my experience. I work now as a public interest lawyer. I supervise what we call a neighborhood justice clinic for low and no income people. And people stream into our office, you know, suffering from this crisis. And every single one of them has got, you know, a tale of how it's affecting them, and everyone feels isolated. And I can't for the life of me direct them to any political project. And next door to us is something called the Long Haul. It was actually started by Al Haber. And it's an anarchist info shop. And so into the anarchists, these young guys come, and I love them all, you know, and they go out to their demonstrations, and they put out their flyers and so on, and they do their community guards. And there's no connection between the people that I see at my clinic and those people there. And there's got somehow to be that. I mean, there has to be something to offer. What it is, how it's going to work, I got no damn idea.
You know, a common line in blues songs is I'm laughing to keep from crying. But the other side of it is no matter how much you put, kill the grass in the cracks of your sidewalk, it keeps coming up again. I saw Mount St. Helens after the volcano. I was in Yellowstone sometime after the huge fire. And damn, the flowers keep coming back. Life asserts itself. Life always asserts itself. People assert themselves. So I don't want anybody to assume that that I was taking a negative tack. The person who brings you bad news, the doctor or nurse who says to you that you're about to go through a really horrible, painful time, but we think you can make it, that's the optimist. The person who says, it's July, but let's have a Christmas party for you, they're the person who's saying you're not going to live to see December. And so I think that imagination means understanding face-to-face that the world can be a whole lot worse than you ever imagined. And any of you here who ever had somebody close to you die knows what I'm talking about. For a time, you're afraid to walk because you don't even know if the floor is going to melt out under your feet. Well, in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, the 300,000 people that died in a 5 minutes' time, if you took those bodies and laid them end-to-end, without an inch in between of space, it would stretch all the way from here to Milwaukee and back. And that's what happened in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Things can be much, much worse than you can ever imagine. The other side of it, though, is that things can also be much, much better than you can ever imagine. And I think that I try not to spend too much time on the first point because I think reality is going to show people that anyhow. So I think it's more important to grasp the second point. The most powerful weapon that oppressors have is convincing people that what exists is natural. It's natural. Whiteness is natural. America is natural. The peacefulness of America is natural. The fact that the United States has 1/4 of all the people in prison in the world are in prison in the United States. 10 million people are in jail in the world. 1/4 of them are in jail in the United States. That's part of the river of blood. Congo, sub-Saharan Africa is our Auschwitz. We have a different kind of Auschwitz today, but it's the same thing. The death, the destruction, the pain, the hardship, the disease. And then there's slow rivers of blood, the obesity, the fact that your generation, maybe not University of Chicago students, because you know about these things, you pay attention to them, but you see it everywhere, that people are going to be getting diabetes massively in this country in their 40s and early 50s as a result of alienation, as a result of people not knowing how to cope with their sense of powerlessness. These are all things that we have to face, all things that we have to deal with. And I think that as capitalism declines, we want to look at history, the U.S. is in decline, period. It can either go the way England did, which was with massive violence, but somewhat gradually, or it can go the way Nazi Germany did, which is throwing bombs this way and that way. I'm not happy about saying this, but I think it's more likely the U.S. will go the second way. Now, we may be able to have some impact on that. I don't believe we can stop a third world war, but I think that we can make a difference as to whether that war kills 60 million or 600 million. And you might say, what the hell, 60 million, that's still so many. But for those who don't die, it's a pretty big difference. So we got to do what we can as far as that's concerned. But I do think that, that despair is a very, very powerful weapon. And I think that we have to fight against that at all costs. And how do I fight against it? Well, there's three ways to avoid that unrealistic sense of despair that poses as being realistic. One way is to have close friends who try to keep you straight and honest. More importantly, though, related to that, is you got to know some history. You got to understand there have been zigs and zags in history before, that after the night comes the day, that the Nazis were defeated, although a tremendous, tremendous human cost. People never imagined it. But the third one is you have to have links to real, live, working-class people. You know, I stumbled into college teaching. I was an activist. And my friend said, oh, you like to talk, go get a job teaching. And I knew I'd never finish my PhD, but somehow I did. I still don't know how that happened. But, you know, and I took a job in, next to Gary, Indiana. You want to see slow rivers, rivers of slow-moving blood? Go to Gary, Indiana, you know. Or for that matter, you could talk to one of my ex-students who was teaching over at Robeson High School, where she would tell me every so often about another one of her students who was killed. So I think that if you have ties to real people, you know, my brother lives in Boulder, Colorado, and actually I was in Santa Fe last weekend. And he keeps on saying, you should move out here. It's so beautiful here. I said, I'm never moving out there. He said, why not? I said, because I'll sit in a chair all day and look at the mountains. I said, I'll only move out there if you let me bring all my friends from Gary. If you let me bring all my friends from the south side of Chicago. If you let me bring people from Pilsen and from Little Village. Then I'll move out there. Because heaven is not in the things, it's in the people. When people say, oh, you're never going to live to see it, what I say, you know, what I say back is, first of all, it meaning a communist world, whatever that'll be. I agree with him on that. Who knows what it'll be and when it'll be. But see, if you say, I'm only going to do it if I know I'm going to see it, then you're pissing on the graves of millions of other people who went out and fought over the last hundreds of years. You're pissing on Frederick Douglass. You're pissing on everybody. You're saying, what a bunch of fools. They fought and they didn't get to see it. The other side of it is if you live your life the right way and you keep the struggle going and you surround yourself. And keeping the struggle going does mean getting involved in reform struggles. I wasn't saying pick up the gun today. But you get involved in those struggles to do what Lenin, in one of his wiser moments, called schools for communism. These struggles become ways for people to learn what the system is made of and how to organize against it. You do have to be involved in these day-to-day struggles. It does no good to stand outside and shout at people and just pass out flyers. But on the other hand, we want to meet people where they're at, but we don't want to just sit down next to them and say, hey, what up? You know, we meet people where they're at in order to struggle with people and move them. But I do think that if you live your life as best as you can, then you are seeing it. You're seeing it as much as anyone will ever see it in the future. That's all I have to say. Oh, one more thing. I have copies of my book, Don't Tell the Publisher, because I'm not supposed to do this. But he sent me a page proof, so I copied a few. If anybody wants the real, a digital version of it, you can pick one up, or I'll email it to you or something. I don't believe in private property.
I have done my level best to keep these guys within bounds, but without as much success as I would like. And for that reason, I think it's important that I go ahead and open up the floor, and if in the course of questions I feel the need to press people to kind of answer the questions that's being asked, then I'll do that, but I'll forego asking questions of my own. But if we could use the microphone. And it's fine to identify your political perspective and so forth and so on, but please try to keep your questions short and to the point.
Well, the panelists, the anti-Marxist platypus, they all have something in common, which is apology for U.S. imperialism, whether saying it's humanitarian, progressive, or can be pressured by classless movements. While this especially carries weight under Obama, who has given bloody U.S. imperialism a facelift, the left wing of the New Left 40 years ago would have been pretty disgusted with your open embrace of imperialism today. But this is the logical progression of their politics. So let me tell you a little bit about the New Left. The political context for the New Left was the Civil Rights Movement and the Vietnam War. Radical students at that time weren't looking to the Democratic Party. That was the same party that was raining napalm bombs in Vietnam and the party of Jim Crow. But most of the New Left also repudiated the working class as the only revolutionary force in society, so the only thing left for these groups was to pressure the Democratic Party, which was seen as the lesser evil. And this inevitably led them to see a more humane side of capitalism. The one group who did oppose the Democrats and fought for a Revolutionary Workers' Party was the Spartacist League. Everyone else fell under the shadows of the Democratic Party. And here I want to say something about Tim Woolforth, who is now a total cheerleader of for U.S. imperialism all around the world. When Woolforth was a part of the Trotskyist movement, he did his sordid role in weakening it. His tendency, the Workers' League, supported cop strikes. Cops aren't part of the working class, and they are the guardians of racist capitalist rule. The Workers' League also took pictures of Iraqi and Libyan leftists and sent those pictures to the Iraqi and Libyan governments. So, you know, he wasn't able to destroy the revolutionary Marxist continuity. The Spartacist League today continues to fight for that continuity, and 40 years after Vietnam, our tasks remain the same. Even in a world that is bleaker, where imperialism has claimed millions of lives, where the Soviet Union no longer exists, our task is still to defend countries where capitalism has been overthrown, like China, North Korea, Cuba, and Vietnam, while fighting for political revolutions in those countries. And we still fight for an
Please try to wind it up and ask a question.
That stands in clear opposition to both the Democrats and Republicans, and fights for black liberation through socialist revolution. So if you're interested fighting for a socialist future, you should check out the Spartacus Youth Club and our newspaper, Spartacus has a Workers' Vanguard. Spartacus has a great article on Woolforth, who is his book.
No, just quickly, that article that she held up, I have three very little points to make about it. One is the picture in there of me is just terrible. You know, I can't believe I looked that bad then. The second is that the article is so old that the paper has turned yellow. It was written in 1995. I suggest you do some new printing. And thirdly, that's it. That's enough.
Okay. There's a question that I want to ask, mostly to the second two panelists, Mark and Osha. When you both kind of talked about the necessity to split, like to have something new, a new left, and Mark, you talked about how you're now a supporter of Obama and you think that there should be, like, that the goal is social democracy. And I'm wondering why your group, I know that there was a lot of different currents in the SDS, but why your particular group that you led felt that they needed something, they needed to break from the old left, that it was no longer about like overcoming capitalism, but as you said, just trying to like kind of buffer down the edges or like get to a kind of a stronger welfare state.
I have a bit of a hearing problem, and most of what you said was lost.
Oh, okay. Why? I'll just like
don't,
condense
don't
it.
Get
no,
old.
Why are you?
Then you have to wear hearing aids and shit like that.
So
I'm sorry, I missed some about 50% of what you said.
Okay, I'll just condense it then. Why do you think that it's not important to overcome capitalism, but rather just make capitalism gentler, to buffer down the edges? Why are you for a stronger welfare state?
Well, for the last few years, I've been reading Monthly Review again, and Monthly Review absolutely predicted the current crisis, economic crisis. That, you know, and every article they'd have, with no exception, would say, and there's a coming economic crisis, and that's why we need socialism. And so let's have socialism. You know, but I think I probably have internalized an observation about the world, which is people are basically lazy.
Oh.
and people are basically apolitical, at least in, the people I know, and in this society. And they don't like to sit in meetings, and socialism means a lot of meetings, you know. I think that capitalism in one form or another is going to be around a while. So let's try to control it as best we can by using the government as a collective will of the people, you know, and we can talk about workers' government or whoever's government, but I think you know, we can't ignore the fact that every country except for Cuba that has ever called itself and North Korea, I guess, I don't know, communist or socialist, has gone in some way or another for capitalism. China is a perfect example. You know, and there's many reasons, and, you know, and there's many problems, and this, that, and the other thing. But I think we're going to have elites. I think we're going to have private ownership. And I think we're going to have a lot of stuff. And so in the meantime, if we can control this whole situation a little better, I think it's a reasonable goal. That's all. Hey, I'm with you. I want to overthrow the whole motherfucker. I hate it all, you know. Capitalism, terrible. Private property is absurd. Santa Fe, New Mexico is one of the most absurd places in the world. Yeah. And I live 60 miles from there, and it's pretty absurd where I live. But and Chicago's pretty absurd. But it ain't going to happen because people don't like to sit in meetings. They want to be left alone. So we got to just control the thing a little better. I'm repeating myself now.
I mean, since you linked me together, I mean, I love my brother Mark.
I was linking you together at the beginning because okay, you were because part of the motherfuckers. You're like more anarchist thing. Well, like, why did you break from the old?
But as you might tell from my remarks, first of all, any state sentence that begins "people are basically dot dot dot," I tend to disagree with, including that they're lazy. I tend to. Question whether it's possible to have, as the Evo Morales quote, nature or capitalism are compatible. I don't know whether it can be reformed. One of the slogans that we had back then that I still believe in, which is be realistic, demand the impossible. And I think, in fact, in some way, the only realism now may be that that capitalism is incompatible with nature. And not reformable, certainly incompatible with democracy, and I guess I disagree with Mark there also, whether we can have a democratic party that's going to even begin to control capitalism. I don't know the answer, but if there isn't that strain of questioning the whole thing and having that as a goal, I don't believe the movement is going to have the energy that it needs.
Okay, that's cool. That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. I arrived a little late, so if I say something that's already been mentioned, I apologize. I come from a place that's younger than you guys, but older than you guys, and maybe I'm more along the line of the 70s show. And I joined the Army when Carter was president, and we've seen a lot of changes. It wasn't until 2002 that I started to take it to the streets and get real about my activism. I think what's happening is we've got a certain amount of ageism at work. I know older activists, organizers have a model. I know younger folks, very tech-oriented and very motivated. In my hand, I have more information than entire societies had access to and communication devices. How do we bring those things together? I would suggest the paradigm shift. There are, we don't call them communes today. They're called intentional communities. I live in one. I know of five right here in the Chicago area. I know several in Virginia and around the country. So it's out there, but I don't know that we're doing real well as far as connecting the new to the old. And I think we get hung up on ideology instead of looking at what do we have to do next. We're decentralized now. None of us are reporting to the central party, the state, the government. We're just doing the next right thing in front of our group. And that's both a strength and a weakness. And I see right now we're missing a prime opportunity when the 40, 50,000 are taking it to the streets in Germany. People have been taking it to the streets in Spain and Greece and Iceland. And where are we? And February 2003, we had 15 million in the streets around the world. To recapture that, I think we're on the cusp of it, but I think we're really dangerous when we start to split off that, you know, this was then and this is now. I want to hear what I need to do next. And I'm working with Catholic Worker as another group, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, put myself out online, got arrested, went to Iran. You know, we can do some things. I think it's real dangerous to wipe it off the map and say, well, you have to print your newspaper, as opposed to putting up a site. So I'd appreciate your feedback.
Thank you. I like your T-shirt.
I'm not sure. Well, it's for Iraq Veterans Against the War.
They're organizing.
Absolutely. And so is Veterans for Peace, the Catholic Workers. So why are we mobilizing around the groups that are working and making some differences and that are in it for the long haul?
Anyone in particular want to take this question?
I made my comment.
Well, I just want to say one thing, and that is to put, I agree with you, but I put that in a little bit of perspective, and that is, I think we have to look at politics, society, and history as a process of conflicting elements, or as Marx said, the class struggle. But that does not necessarily mean that the class struggle is, in a Hegelian sense, going to produce some utopian solution in which there is no further movement or struggle. So if you look at things that way, then you say we have to struggle. We have to struggle inside the Democratic Party. We have to struggle outside the Democratic Party. We have to, in that sense, I view myself the person who I would recommend reading is read the latest book of Tony Jute, who just passed away, which is a brilliant book about what he calls social democracy, about this kind of continuing constant struggle that we have to be part of between private and public, between the interests of the masses and the interests of the few.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, but I think there is a whole hell of a lot of stuff happening right now all over, and the fact that it's decentralized and not in one big organization that can get screwed up the way SDS was actually may be a pretty good thing. And I also think from my experience in the 50s was that I would never have expected the sudden burst of what happened in the 60s and the 50s. It just seemed impossible. And so the impossible happened suddenly. And, you know, it ain't going to happen from necessarily from where we expect it. But I think all the work, when people talk about the long haul and all the work that people are doing now in myriad different ways is all the seedbed so that when that spark happens, I think it's going to be greater. And I actually think, you know, it's tragic what happened, but I think the result of all of that was the movement that put Obama into office, which showed that there actually is a progressive majority in the United States. It was utterly betrayed, you know, terribly, utterly betrayed. But the fact that there was that movement is a result of all the work that people done. Now we need a movement that's not betrayed and that comes out of the people and is not organized from above.
One quick comment to that end. I believe there are two flashpoints. Yes, absolutely. If Obama gets assassinated, cities will burn. If the draft is reinstated, I think we'll see a lot more out here for these sort of events.
We need the draft, absolutely.
You know what? Let him talk. Okay.
As we say, as people who are not going to be drafted,
yeah.
The panel here is not. The panel here is not going to be drafted.
No, but my grandchildren would be drafted, I'm willing to sacrifice him for the larger good.
I'm not willing to sacrifice my grandchildren.
Yes, I am.
I'm Benjamin Button. I'm getting younger.
My grandson is no more important than anybody else.
So I want to get back to this question of the extent to which sort of the new left and the new left are inherently marginal in their politics. Because I think something that sort of has been implicit is that if you're a student activist and you're working for revolution in the United States, at least that combination of characteristics inherently makes you marginal. And I think going back to what Osha was saying about how
it's very hard from that position of marginality to connect to working class folk, to connect to people who perhaps don't have the privilege that we as white university students have to be marginal and not really face serious consequences for it, sort of gets in the way of our ability to engage with those groups in productive ways. And I was wondering also, bringing back the Animal Enterprise Act, the extent to which it seems to be the case that the government keeps restricting the tactics and techniques that activists can use, right? And so how can we continue to work in the system? Because I think if we work completely outside the system, as has been noted, that's a huge red flag in the bad way to working class groups. But at the same time, working within the system just restricts the tactics that are available to us. So how do we reconcile those two things?
Well, that's the most important question, but I really believe that there's not a fundamental impossible bridge, gap to bridge, whatever the phrase is here. I think that that's a very insightful point, and that was certainly true in the 1960s. It's one thing to get kicked out of Harvard or Columbia or Yale or Princeton, and it's another thing to get beaten on the head by a police on the east side of Detroit and then face 20 years in jail. But I do believe that getting involved in local struggles, having your life directly linked to people, and I don't like the rhetoric of privilege that's used a lot, in a sense, because it could become very moralistic, give up your privilege. But I would say people should certainly risk, at all costs, risk what they have. I mean, two of my students who became activists then went to Iraq specifically to organize inside the army. I would also say that part of it is we have to confront the fact that we do have to eventually build a movement that isn't necessarily all out there. That doesn't necessarily mean collectives, you know, hiding guns in the basement and fantasizing about this and that. But realistically speaking, there were co-ops in Italy, and then they were smashed. There were all kinds of communes and alternative institutions and this is and that's, and they smashed them. So the question, I think the real question for our era, and I think your generation is going to see a much, much more horrible life than my generation saw. I really believe that. The question is really the question of leadership, and there are two aspects to that. If we say there shouldn't be any leadership at all, or it should be a weak leadership in order to keep it from becoming bureaucratized, all that that will do is allow rotten leadership to dominate. So the real paradox is, how can we have a strong, cohesive, collective leadership? You have to have that. If you say you don't want it, it's like nature hates a vacuum. Somebody's going to be the leader. That's it. The problem with anarchism isn't that it shouldn't be a free society. It's that the biggest bullies will beat the crap out of everybody and they'll run things anyway unless you abolish classes. So I think the struggle to develop leadership that is beholden to the people that they claim to represent, and I think that's a lot of the spirit of the Cultural Revolution, which nobody has spoken about today, actually, which is one of the most inspiring things of the 1960s, with all the weaknesses and all the problems. It's not easy. I think that gets resolved in practice. I think people have to build movements. I think we can, you know, like the Whittier struggle, some of my students were involved in that. You get involved in these reform struggles, but not simply to win the reform. If you do it in order to learn and to teach and to teach and to learn, and to try to build collectives and build movements that eventually will last. Frederick Douglass was once 3 years old. Lenin once spilled his milk. Ho Chi Minh washed dishes. In other words, it's not like all the stuff was inevitable. There clearly were people who you had no idea. I've been teaching long enough to know you can have an impact on people, and then you have no idea the impact you had on them until years later. So that's why I think the optimism is what's key. But I think that people who are isolated from real live rank and file people in struggle, I think they tend to get cynical. I think despair and cynicism is a luxury of the middle class. It's a luxury of intellectuals, because people in Congo, they don't have the luxury to be cynical. They have to fight for their lives every minute of every day.
Who Hello. This is a question about a sort of, this is a question about the critique of capital, and more specifically, I think it's probably mostly addressed to Mark Rudd. Probably other members of the panel will find interest. It's basically a question about if we see capital as a system with its own internal logic, how is it that we can blame certain features of it on various groups that are, like, in some sense, the ruling class is itself subject to capital, and therefore to blame the defeats of some, to blame the betrayal of the progressive left on Obama is to ignore the fact that there are structural features that make it impossible to have a left. And the, and so this, is, of course, is a major issue, I think.
I didn't understand the question.
The question basically is, if how do you critique capital as a system that dominates every aspect of life and therefore removes all questions of sort of, like Tom Hayden talks about the Machiavellians in his book, and I find that as a, I think I would follow the anti-Deutschist lead and call it functionally anti-Semitic in that it describes
you
to
find
a,
that a what?
Functionally anti-Semitic argument in that it describes to a small cabal of people the product, like it describes to a small group of people the property of carrying out the functions of capital.
If I could just cut.
I still don't understand the point.
I think the real sort of thrust of the student's question is that he's saying, you know, how do you, if we really are talking about a society that we believe to be radically transformable, then isn't in some essential sense the requirement to account for the inadequacies of our own left movements, rather than to identify, you know, that, well, the ruling class had this agency or had that agency that was relatively effective in smashing us here or doing, you know, COINTELPRO did that then, you know, but rather to say, you know, if there's a total system that in some sense is generating, you know, unfreedom and social domination, then don't we have to really turn to the question of what is the inadequacy of our own left politics in the past? That's really very much in the spirit of the panel. So, which
is
why
that your question?
That will do for an equivalent to the question.
Sort of the question, as I understand the question, and Spencer's interpretation of the question, is something about the total power of capital.
Yes, capital
it has
is
so
a world
much
system.
Power that it what.
That capital dominates every aspect of life. So one of the criticisms I heard you making were criticisms of sort of agency. There is a power in the world that advances the cause of capital independently of capital, and I'm arguing that no, capital inherently has a logic that leads to the results we see. There is no
that
man
leads
behind the curtain.
To what?
The results we see.
The what?
The results.
Can I
what
try?
Result?
Yeah. Let me try.
I think don't understand
Mark,
the words.
Mark, I think what he's saying is that when capitalism does all these horrible things, it's capitalism's job description to do that. When capitalism does all these horrible things, it's capitalism's job description to do all these horrible things.
It's
capitalism's
That's
job
capitalism
description.
Does.
In other words, it's
right.
what it does. Yeah. And therefore, instead of saying that it keeps doing these bad things and that's what's stifling us, it's like saying there's a snowstorm in Chicago and complaining about it instead of saying that's what Chicago is. So therefore, what are we going to do about it? What he's saying is we get our agency not by complaining or blaming it on what capitalism does, but by acknowledging, well, what do you expect? That's what capitalism is supposed to do. So now, what can we look to in terms of our own weaknesses to overcome that, to get that shovel? I think that's what you meant.
Was?
Oh, he's shaking his head. I'm right.
Can we get on?
Was that it?
Let's just answer some question.
Okay. I want to answer his question.
Well, answer any question so that we can get the discussion going.
Get a shovel.
We got people here that want to ask other questions.
No, I know, but I like his question.
He said get a shovel.
Well, then answer.
What it is.
Believe me, they're going to ask good questions.
Okay.
Go
engaged.
Was there more? Was the response. Okay. I guess my question is, for the panel, particularly for Alan, do you think that the failure of left politics in the 60s, I mean, because you didn't identify the organization that you worked for, but whatever that is, was that, were the failures of the 60s necessary? I guess is the first question. And then for the whole panel, I mean, talking about things getting worse in the future, I mean, is that necessary and why?
I think necessary is like inevitable. All truth is probabilistic. That's an important concept. I like to use the term probably inevitable, and then people, my sociology friends, laugh at me.
So to make the question more pointed is, like, what were the failures?
The failures, I probably ran through them really fast. I'll say it again. Number one was the left itself, worldwide, was in a state of retreat. Despite the fact that there was this revolutionary upsurge in 68, in fact, it was more like a death rattle when you looked at the underlying processes that led to the collapse in China and Russia were already in place. That's number one. And then I don't know that it was completely defeated. I mean, I'm still here. These guys are all trying to do something. There are countless hundreds, thousands of people who became school teachers and social workers and community organizers out of that who did try to at least spread some aspects of Marxist ideas, whether or not it was always self-conscious. But I do think that if I could go back in time and change some things with respect to the white left movement, I would say the struggle against racist oppression specifically, and to me, Worker Student Alliance was a term bandied about, meant uniting the students with the working class as a whole, and the movement was really inadequate and weak with respect to that. So I think that would have been important to change. But other than that, some of it really was, you know, there's ebbs and flows. You know, there's a whole, it's interesting, even in physics, there's an understanding that every process, when it reaches a limit, the second law of thermodynamics, everything dissipates, but there's one small part of it that rises to a higher level. And you see that that's true in the plant and animal evolution. It's actually true in quantum mechanics. I think it's true in social movements. So the question is, can you nurture that small part that's more advanced and develop it so that when these moments come that he talked about, we have the ability, and if you have a base among common people, to take advantage of those moments. But, you know, that's what I would say in the short term, that it was a failure of the, certainly of the campus movement, to reach out to the community. That was the internal weakness. Although I think that as far as the why it shrunk, that was going to happen. I mean, the world situation was just what it was.
Tim, Mark,
Gosha, I mean, just...
Yeah, I just wanted to say one quick thing. I think that we're getting into, that we're sort of stumbling around this question of what you might call there's this kind of contradiction in Marx and between his determinism and his whole concept of the dialectic and of the struggle. In other words, you can look at capitalism and say that it's everything, they control everything, the ruling class runs everything, you can't fight them, they run you. That's all there is, and what can you do about it? Or you can also look at the side of Marx that says within the system itself, the very nature of the system promotes and requires rebellion so that you then have a struggle, and your decision as individuals is whether you want to be part of that kind of essentially class struggle that is going on in this country as well as elsewhere.
It just, you know, the issue of what was necessary. Necessity is always retrospective. Yeah. I mean, at the time, we didn't know what was possible. Mm-hmm. And there's a realm of freedom in the moment which disappears in the retrospective glance. I mean, obviously what happened for causes, and one cause led to another. But there's also such a thing as a realm of freedom, how large it is. One doesn't know until one exercises it. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't know, but we tried to exercise it.
May I? Sure. I think that capitalism does, in reference to your question, I think capitalism is pretty strong. You know, it's created a lot of ideas in people's heads, and it's a way of life, and it's an MP3 and an iPhone and a this and a that. You know, capitalism is what we got. The Chicago Bulls, that's capitalism. You know, it's people's lives. On the other hand, and then you're right in referring to Tom Hayden's book. He talks about movements against the Machiavellians, that there's always these elites. But he also says that countering the elites are the movements from the bottom, mass movements. And they have historically been transformed our country. So, and the world. And they are doing it now. So we happen to, the reason I picked the Democratic Party is because we happen to have this form, and this refers to the previous question that you asked, we have this form of government, of politics handed us, which has something to do with the ability to organize and the ability to speak and the ability, they're called the various civil liberties and civil rights. Now, they are being eroded. You're absolutely right. We should have a big fight over the right to eliminate the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. I mean, there should be. There must be a fight because that's part of the environmental movement is against the exploitation of animals. But we have the capacity to carry on that fight within legal means and fundamentally nonviolent ones. When we do it in any other means, we are marginalized extremely. I'm here to tell you, I tried it. It don't work.
I would just say, though, that I was also with a group of 2,000 people who chased the police and chased the Nazis out of Evanston on more than one occasion. So violence, if it's done by masses of people who understand what they're doing and why, is, in my opinion, entirely appropriate. But when a few people try to substitute themselves, that's when you run into big trouble. You cannot substitute yourself in the masses.
I want to just comment on this. It is a panel still.
Go ahead.
No, but Alan talked about those bombs at Fort Dix that accidentally went off prematurely and killed three of our own people. Thank God they only killed three of our own people and not the targets, because that would have been a horrible, horrible setback for the anti-war movement. We did have a setback in Madison, Wisconsin, when some people tried to emulate the Weathermen and accidentally killed a graduate student, and the anti-war movement collapsed for a while in Madison. There's a great book on this called Rads by Tom Bates. So one of the many arguments for nonviolence is that your mistakes aren't so bad. But when you pick up the gun or the bomb or the this, or you hit a cop, or, you know, at Columbia, we tried to be nonviolent, but we didn't put it forward as our strategy. So there was a lot of gray areas, you know, like burning a professor's papers, or a guy jumped on the back of a cop, and the cop was injured for the rest of his life. Was that struggle worth it for the cop to get injured? I got a letter from that cop's son. So I'm just saying the mistakes you make aren't so bad if you stick to nonviolence. But if you do something, anyway, you got the point.
This will be the last question.
This is a question about linguistics and critical categories. Excuse me, sorry. So my question relates to linguistics and critical categories. Basically, everybody on the panel sort of has a separate, you know, their own personal political opinion, right? And my question is kind of pointed towards, I guess, more people on the panel who feel more liberal, I suppose. But honestly, anybody can take up the question of critical categories, specifically Marxist categories and their continuing relevance to political organizing. I mean, obviously, sort of a general thrust of the panel has been organizing. My curiosity is sort of how you feel the categories of traditional Marxism, sort of the categories of like surplus value, you know, valorization process, the labor process, just the way Marx typically describes how capitalism operates, how you sort of interface that with your own politics, and how you, I don't know, either reject them as sort of marginal to contemporary organizing. I mean, certainly the contemporary labor movement has sort of rejected that discourse in favor of, like, more of just a discourse emphasizing the values of America's middle class. Definitely the Obama movement sort of emulated discourse of America's middle class as well. So I guess to put a point on it, I'm just curious if you feel that there's a continuing relevance and how you would interface that in contemporary organizing of, you know, a discourse that's critical of capitalism based in, like, a Marxist text.
I can answer that for myself very, very succinctly. I don't think it matters. I really don't think it matters, terminology. The concepts of Marx have survived amazingly well. Mm-hmm. And why we have to impose this 19th century language on people, I don't understand. But the concepts there, the concepts of struggle, the concepts of that the money has gotten into the hands of an elite, and the masses have gotten so impoverished that the economic system collapses. That's what we have to talk about. And I think that we could do well to forget about, not forget about, but use among ourselves, but not in any other sense than, you know, a lot of academic jargon that's out there.
So if I can just sort of rephrase this question. So on the one hand, you're saying that Marxist concepts are extremely important and explanatory, and on the other hand, they're 19th century. And I guess I feel like, you know, the question of, you know, in the 1960s, I think it was easier to imagine even
outside of the framework of the Soviet Union or China or other existing communisms, that Marxism was relevant. And that something about the reconstitution of a new, that the constitution of a new left would mean in some sense recovering the project of overcoming capitalism. And so just to kind of put a point on this man's question, does it really make no difference if we say that the concepts are explanatory? Wouldn't we be saying essentially that those concepts are explanatory but banal to say if they're explanatory, yet it's not relevant that we organize our politics with reference to our understanding of this as a capitalist society in the Marxian terms?
I mean, I kind of hate that this is the last question, frankly. It's not about the language. I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of the thinking about the system, I used to call it the system, and it sounds not Marxist, but it is in the sense that, you know, the way the commodity form of capitalism penetrates all aspects of our lives and therefore can be challenged in all aspects. I mean, in the shorthand for me, the analysis is Marxist, but the practice has been anarchist. And, you know, what matters for me for Marx is I don't know economics. I try and understand economics. And frankly, I wish I could, but I actually don't. I have no idea whether the labor theory of value, there's a declining rate of profit, whether it seems like capitalism is necessarily going to have problems of overproduction, commodification. But to end up having to worry about Marx's categories, and I agree with Tim, you know, we're trying to find a language that speaks to my people who come into my clinic, my neighborhood justice clinic, and how am I going to talk to them? You know, I can have all this shit in my head, but am I going to talk to them about that? I better figure out a language that reaches people and a practice that reaches people. And that's much more important for me than trying to figure out where I fit in and how much of it is Marxist and how much of it is anarchist.
I think you need to meet people where they're at, but not just sit down with them. And so, therefore, the not just sitting down with them means people do have to understand science as good as possible, as well as possible. And that means understanding the processes. Marx's ideas, to me, are parallel those of Darwin's. They're historically useful within a framework anyway, not necessarily true for all time, but they're very, very important and valuable, and the concepts need to be understood. On the other hand, it's possible to use different words. The big question is always, when is using a different word diluting the concept, eviscerating it completely? So that's always a question. But as far as do the concepts and categories of Marx still hold today, I would say for the most part they do, because Marxism is a living science. Anytime anybody says, well, Marx was a dogmatist who didn't believe in the importance of ideas, I always remind them that he wrote 50 books by hand. So he obviously thought ideas were pretty important, and he was more creative in his, you know, and he had that famous quote, I am not a Marxist, you know. So he saw it as a living thing as well. He wasn't trying to necessarily write truth for a million years. But I think his truths still hold today for the most part. His concepts, his analysis maybe is a better way to put it, his science.
I mentioned that my goal, which I'm hoping other people will join, is social democracy. And as far as I know, the history of social democracy, it's always been the struggle between capital. Is that a Marxist category? Right. Capital and labor. Right. You know, and that's what brings about social democracy. We're so far from social democracy right now in this country because capital has triumphed and labor has is powerless or has given in. You know, organized labor. So it's going to be capital versus labor. Now, what words we use for it, I don't know. It'll be something about social networking. I don't know what it's going to be. But that's the Marxist categories that we're dealing with. We have a crisis of capitalism. The only thing that I know has ever successfully fought capitalism is labor. On the other hand, we can call it whatever it is. You know, I don't know.
I think we have agreement.
Yeah. We'll hang with it.
The panel, anyway, I think, has agreement.
Yes, no. Marco, is it a quick question?
Yeah. Quick question. It was what I had. It's unfortunate that the Spartacist comrades here have left the room. What I wanted to say was I wanted to second some of their characterization of the new left, you know, the disavowal of labor as a constituency to produce change in society, you know, the inability to produce integrated organizing, and the sort of endless focus on the inability to organize, right? The focus on consensus organizing, which whatever what happened in 1968, 69, but what I think is a real problem is that you know, having organized people recently, the imagination from that era, the kind of the imagination of the endless consensus meeting and the white guilt and the disavowal of labor as a possible source of social change, these things sort of continued. So even if the movements of the 60s are kind of like sort of withered and died, there is a way in which the imagination people here created, and I'm thinking specifically about you know, the ex-weatherman and the ex-motherfucker, you know, it still exists. And I want to hear how you guys feel about whether how people think about leftist politics today, what sort of responsibility they have, you know, these historical echoes that you've produced.
I mean, I don't know. This is another whole hour, right? Essentially what we talked about. I mean,
I have no idea what he's talking about.
Well, I know.
I heard the word responsibility.
You said responsibility.
I don't know what the rest was. Something about responsibility.
Don't.
Maybe we should just call it quits at this point.
Yeah. No response.
I just don't agree. I have.
If the audience.
No, we have no response.
We here on the panel are totally lost too.
Can I say? I just want to say
that we have. I don't agree.
If we are wrapping up, I just wanted to say that I live 25 minutes from here, so if anybody has any, you know, wants to come up and talk or have me come in and we'll split a pizza at Medici's or whatever, I'd be happy to come in and talk to anybody about anything at any time because I love to talk.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to continue talking, we should be on the same
feel free to take any of this junk like over this here if you like.
I mean, we're going to talk.
Yeah.
I would like everyone to please give a round of thanks to our panelists. Thank you.
I like the idea of just sitting around talking, but I just want to say that a little bit this reminds me of a story. A man walks into a psychiatrist, and he's wrapped completely wrapped up in saran wrap and nothing else. And the psychiatrist looks at him and says, "I can clearly see you're nuts."
Got it. Let's talk.
I don't get it. I can clearly. Wait a minute.
All right.
Oh, wait. No. Wait. I don't. I don't get it. I can clearly. Oh yeah. Here. Oh, is that out of people's ears?